So I'm just waiting for Jeff to get off the phone. He's almost done.
I didn't even get to the message that I need to listen to.
You can keep listening.
No, let's do it.
Okay. You're so committed to this show.
I am.
So this week I spoke to Wendy. I keep meaning to. I've known her for years, and I keep, every time I see her, I forget to ask her how to pronounce her last name.
It's Bourgeois, isn't it?
I don't know.
Well, okay.
Or it's spelled Bourgeois, but maybe it's Bourgeois. I don't know.
I don't think it's Bourgeois. I think I'm pretty sure it's Wendy Bourgeois.
Okay.
I guess you. Okay.
I didn't ask. And good. I didn't. And I also, like, avoided saying her last name to her.
Which is the mark of a true radio professional by just dodging anything problematic and just. I respect your candor.
Thank you. So I think I did this in the interview. Maybe no is too big of a word, but you know, we've run into each other a lot, and I've always admired her, not only for her poetry, but just her style. And she seems to me like a very sort of a poet from another time, when I feel like poets at least appeared more confident, and they were, I can't even say it. Maybe the opposite of me.
They seem more confident? You think poets are confident these days?
No, in the old days they were.
Because their art form mattered, and now it doesn't.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Maybe, yeah. I mean,
well,
I'm
a poet. I can totally say that.
Yeah, I mean, and which is interesting because she's definitely, you know, she's of our time now. And she probably deals with the same thing that every poet does, which is trying to, like, be heard.
I thought you were going to say getting too big too fast.
Yeah, yeah, right. Well, there's
having
that too
many fans. That's my biggest problem as a writer, is I have too many fans.
Yeah, but you're dealing with it really well. You stay really down.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have the bags. When they bring in the bags of fan mail, I have them alphabeticalized, and then I get back to them 6 months later, yeah.
The alphabeticalized?
That's a word.
Yeah. Now you got me off my train
Wendy.
Of thought with Wendy.
You interviewed her. You don't know how to pronounce her last name. You think she's confident.
She comes off as confident. I just like hearing her talk. I like hearing her read her own work. She's just very genuine, and she has what people that I admire always have, which is it seems like they can't be anybody but themselves.
Mm-hmm. An authenticity that you don't have. You said that she has something that you don't.
That's not what I said.
Well...
But it's
fine. You implied it.
Yeah. So what are you having for dinner tonight, Jeff?
Probably a burrito.
Oh. Are you going to make it or buy it from
somewhere? Buy it somewhere and then just cry into it later, home alone.
I made a huge pumpkin soup today with fresh pumpkin. And
pumpkin pie or pumpkin soup?
Soup. With my own broth. So I started.
I don't know if I've had a lot of pumpkin soup.
You want to come over?
Yes, I would.
All right. My wife and child will be there.
Okay.
So you'll have
so
to,
I should eat in the garage while you have a family meeting? Is that what you meant?
Well, you have kind of a potty mouth.
Are you mental? I never swear. I never swear. I'm serious.
I know. I wasn't being serious.
Sarcasm is the first failure in a person.
Is it?
It's one of them.
Why?
Only God knows.
Yeah. I feel like this intro just deflated.
Wendy.
Oh, yeah. We're back to Wendy. So Wendy's great. You should...
She has a new book out from Propeller Books.
Oh,
check that out.
Thank you. Oh, obviously. Yeah.
True professional. Wendy Bourgeois. Wendy Bourgeois.
Yay. Welcome to the steer. Is that good?
Yeah, that's good. That's really kind of like
a good intonation.
Well, I don't mean on the air, but I just mean in general because, well, whatever. Yeah, it's good.
I'm going to get sweaty. Forgive me. I always get sweaty when I do these things.
Am I going to get sweaty? Is that just the thing that happens?
No, it's just me because of my like social anxiety, whatever.
Interesting profession for someone with social anxiety.
Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Sonny.
I was trying to think of how long I've known you. And known, of course, is a funny word because I never really see you. But I think many years. Okay, so I was thinking on the way over of the different encounters I've had with you over the years. And I think the first time I met you was 6 years ago, something like that, at the Waypost at a reading.
Yep.
The reading series.
Mm-hmm. Was it 1,000 words? Was it that one?
Yeah, exactly. 1,000 words with
Melissa.
Thank you, Melissa.
Favara.
Good, Favara, yeah. And we were sitting next to each other waiting to read, and you said something like, is this your first time? And I nervously said, no, of course not. I do readings all the time.
It probably was my first time to do that particular one.
Mm-hmm.
And I only do readings if someone asks me to, because I don't like it.
Yeah.
Do you like it? Do you like doing it?
Only when I do well. Only if people laugh at something that I want to be funny. Then I love it when it's done.
Oh, when it's done. That's right. That's the best time.
Anyway, then I saw you several years later and at some reading that you did. You were invited to at like the Ford. It's okay if you don't remember.
The Ford. No, the I Ford don't remember that one drink. At all.
Yeah. Well, you were leaving and I went up to stop you to say, hey, Wendy, that was great. And you gave me this blank stare. You're like, who the hell are you? And I said, it's Sunny. I had you at, because I had hosted you at a reading series that I had hosted. And you said, oh, I thought you had blonde hair. And then you left.
When I thought that when I saw you again today. In my mind, you are blonde.
That's funny.
You're totally not blonde.
I was blonde until I was 4. And then it switched. I don't know why.
But you were way older than 4 when I met you for the first time. So I don't know why blonde.
That depends. Where are you from?
Where am I from?
Mm-hmm.
Southeast Texas.
Okay, yeah, we didn't meet. No. But anyway, that's it. But then tonight when you came in, it highlighted how much I don't know you because it's the first time I noticed your accent.
Mm-hmm.
That's the... See, I'm also going to ask questions too. Let's see, what can I say?
And then we met because you recorded me read.
Yeah, that was wildly awkward.
And then you, my best friend, lives in your old house.
Oh, yeah. Rodenbush?
Yep.
Kira.
Hi, Kira. That always makes me think extra fondly of you.
Oh.
She loves that house so much.
It's a great house.
And she had been in like an apartment before.
Yeah.
With her giant brood. So she has all that space to spread out.
Yeah. She has a lot of kids, right?
3.
Yeah. Yeah. That's... So anyway, it's nice to actually have time because I think this will be the longest conversation we've had.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, it's about time.
Yeah.
We've been acquaintances now for 6 years.
Yeah. Your book just came out. Well, this recording, I should say, will come out probably after the official release of your book.
Okay.
So
it's 10:30.
Yeah. So let's. Oh, yeah. It will come. This recording will actually come out after that. So let's pretend. Your book is already out. Congratulations. Is this your first published book?
Yes.
I was trying to find a published poetry of yours.
It's hard to find.
Yeah.
It exists. It's out there. Most of my I hate submitting poems for publication. It's so demoralizing. Mm-hmm. I do get picked, so I do it like 3 times a year, and then every now and then I'll get something picked up. But it's always in like a small press journal that, you know, is in, there's 500 copies of it somewhere. Maybe you could buy one in Powell's, but they're not just around.
Right. But they must be online somewhere.
I think most of my publications, except for my Propeller ones, are not online.
Oh, that's why I can't find them.
Yeah, I think they're just in books.
Oh, bummer. I mean, that's cool that they're in books.
Mm-hmm. No, I guess now online is better, right?
Well, it's easier to find.
It's not as fancy, but it's easier to find. And more people read it.
Yeah, I don't think it's as satisfying for the author unless it's a site that has a lot of traffic. I would think it's nicer to actually get it in the mail. Like, wow, they put it on this nice binding.
Yep, it makes it seem important.
Yeah. But congratulations on this.
Thank you.
The Devil Says Maybe I Like It from Propeller. I remember you saying something to me once about, correct me because I'm maybe messing this up, but you said something about how growing up working class made it always a challenge to, you had to keep reminding yourself that poetry, it's okay to do poetry.
Yes.
Okay.
I still feel that way.
Yeah.
That has not gone away.
Yeah.
Yes.
I suspect that would also make it doubly hard or more than doubly hard to submit to sort of make, try and get it published in book or other forms.
Yeah, absolutely. It feels like a weird hobby.
How often do you spend, how often do you sit down to write actively?
So I mentioned that there's an essay that mentions this. I have a real on-again, off-again relationship with writing poetry in particular.
Yeah.
There are some things that feel like they can only be said in a poem. But since I've started writing longer essays, they feel so much more spacious. And unfortunately also, because this is vain, people respond to them so much better.
Yeah.
I don't think as many people don't read poetry as they do essays. And also, I think it matters that to me that the essays seem to communicate to people better maybe than my poems.
I think it's completely valuable and understandable that if something resonates, you're going to be more inspired to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I totally get that.
Right. I think you're not supposed to be. I think you're supposed to, like, care so much about the art that it doesn't matter if anyone else reads it or whatever. But I'm not Emily Dickinson, and I do care, kind of.
It's always sounded like an impossible ideal to work without an audience.
Yeah, or to not care about communicating.
Yeah.
You know, you are communicating.
Yeah.
Even if you're doing it alone in your room.
Right. And so if there's not another side of the conversation, it feels crazy.
Mm-hmm. It feels a little hollow. And
yeah.
So I think I started to feel like poems were a little bit hollow. And poetry in general, because poets read each other's poems.
Mm-hmm.
But I ask, you know, 150 people a term if any of them read poetry, and they never do. Crickets.
Yeah. You highlighted that really well in the is it an intro? I forget what it's called. Yeah, your introduction. You explained that really well, your relationship with poetry. It was really beautiful. I mentioned before we turned on the mics, so I feel like I should say this mildly in my defense. Your book just arrived today, so I haven't read all of it, but what I've read, I love.
Thank you.
Yeah. How often do you go shoe shopping?
It depends. It depends on how many classes I have, but I would go shoe shopping super regularly. I probably gotten it down to like a tasteful 3 or 4 times a year.
Mm-hmm. How successful are you when you go?
I think less and less so because I'm more and more particular. I want a very specific thing. And so finding that thing gets harder. And then once I find a thing, I used to never wear a pair of shoes to death.
Mm-hmm.
But now when I find one I like, I wear them till they fall apart. And I also don't drive. I walk everywhere. So I'm really hard on my shoes. So they have to be not just fashionable and adorable, but they also have to be sturdy and practical.
Yeah. So you typically go out looking for one pair, and you typically return with one pair?
Yes.
That's exactly what I do, but I tend to do it until my one pair falls apart, and then I go.
And then you go get another one. What if you get bored with that one, though?
I don't.
You don't ever get bored with your shoes?
No, I find I typically always find a pair of shoes that's just perfect for everything that I need. And I don't like having to think about it.
Is it all practical, or do you want them to look a certain way?
There's definitely a stylish, an aspect. It's very much practical, but the look is also really important.
Yeah, well, if you're going to be wearing them till they fall apart, it better be.
That's what a friend of mine, she goes to what they call them, the naked lady parties, where women get together and trade all their clothes. And I was kind of jealous because why aren't there naked man parties? But it's because we wear...
That's a different party. There are.
Well, no, but we
it's
wear...
not the same.
We wear our clothes to death. And if we did it, it'd be like, do you want this thing with five holes? No. No, I don't. That's why we don't do it. When did you start writing these? These are all, in your new book, these are all essays from your column with Propeller.
Yep.
When did you start that column?
4 or 5 years ago. I was not conceiving them as a book. I just wanted to, I wanted to have a bigger space to write about things. And I had this idea that you could marry the personal essay and criticism. Mm-hmm. Oscar Wilde that says all criticism is autobiography, and I really liked that idea. So, and I had the space and the opportunity to do that for Propeller, and so 4 or 5 years ago maybe. And then I think if I had thought of them as all one thing, it would have been difficult for me to do, and I would have thought about it very differently. But having it is kind of like having the nicest possible journal of your past 5 years.
Yeah. When you look back at them, does it have the same effect as the way smells can bring you back?
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. And I mean, I tried to be really close to the sensory experience in them. So yeah, absolutely. And when I started writing them, I was a single parent. Like, life was really hard at that time for me. And I can see it. I can remember that. And I can see how much has changed. And it makes me happy.
It sounds like you're in a better place, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Are your kids all grown now?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Both off on their own. Eldest working at a doggy daycare and learning how to be a tattoo artist. Younger in New York.
Oh,
in
wow.
College.
Cool.
In New York City.
Mm-hmm.
I have a husband and two dogs and no kids, and
great.
It's so much easier.
Yeah. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Was there not a little bit of, when the last one left, the sort of that emptiness?
Oh my God, I was devastated.
Okay. Yeah.
Absolutely devastated.
Yeah.
It was really, really hard. And I would say, I tend to grieve things before they happen rather than after.
Oh.
So like the 6 months before both of them left, really, really hard. Different because I hadn't gone through it before with the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the second one, I knew like that was it. That was the baby out of the house.
Yeah.
And I always thought that people who had like empty nest, I was just like, what are you doing with your life?
Right.
Like, why is this hard? This is natural. It was really hard.
Yeah.
I mean, you're a parent.
Yeah. Yeah. My kid's only 11.
But 11, it's coming.
It'll be fast, but it's also slow. It's so hard to describe how it goes.
It speeds up about 15.
Yeah. I can imagine that's when they're so independent that you feel already the detachment is already beginning.
It's not even that. It's more that they seem cooked.
Oh.
Like they reach a point in their personality development where you think, there's nothing really more for me to do. I mean, I can keep them fed and clothed, and it probably wouldn't be good for them if I died or ran away. But they're like, they're cooked. They're gelled. If I disappeared tomorrow, they'd be okay.
Yeah.
And then it's like, it's that feeling that you're like, oh, they don't need me anymore to kind of shape them or control their lives. That's partially independence, but it's also partially is like something else.
Yeah. I like that. That's a really good image. So you just have to sort of make sure that they have their basic needs.
Mm-hmm.
Was it harder to talk to them? Because right now I've got a great relationship with my kid and he tells me everything, and I don't know when that's going to stop.
I've been incredibly lucky.
Oh, cool.
My kids talk to me quite openly.
Cool.
Now, I will say my younger son will eventually tell me everything, but he will hold on to things for 3 months.
Mm.
And then so I have to be patient. But they are pretty, both of them. I never had a period where I felt like I had no idea what was going on in their lives. Mm-hmm. And we're a talky family.
Yeah.
So if you live with people who talk nonstop, they'll end up letting something slip, even if they didn't mean to let something slip, you'll eventually hear it.
That's great. That's really good. I definitely have made a big effort to not, because I feel like my parents would mock me quickly. So I learned quickly, like, oh, I'm not going to share anything. And so I'm very sensitive about, you know, being really open with my kid about anything he wants to ask about. It sounds like you had the same approach, similar.
Yeah, open. And also, I think especially in adolescence, not giving them the impression that they're going to be in trouble.
Yeah.
If they tell you about their, you know, adventures with sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Yeah.
Which is, it's a tenuous balance because you don't want to say, like, go bananas.
Right, right.
But you also want them to feel like if they tell you, you're not going to lose your marbles.
I always feel like at that age, the kids that are really going bananas are the ones that aren't talking to their parents. I feel like if you are talking to them, you're probably going to be a little bit more responsible because no one really wants to get hurt.
No one wants to disappoint mom. That's no fun.
Also, yeah. All right.
And they were good. I mean, I don't know. It doesn't seem like teenagers behaved the way teenagers behaved when I was a teenager.
Oh, in what way? Do you think you guys partied more?
Yeah.
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 I have heard, I feel like I see headlines every now and then are saying millennial kids don't drink as much and don't do whatever as much, which is probably good.
Yeah, I think that that's true. I mean, well, it could be good, except it could also not be good because what they're doing instead is living online.
Yeah.
And so they're not having like
real
human experiences.
Yeah, that does seem really weird and plastic and artificial.
But I mean, maybe that's because we're old. That's why we think that.
Yeah, that's true. I do think every older generation looks at the young people like, that's not what we did.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to bring up. This is great. I'm sound of my typing. I'm bringing up. You sent me a list of music that you like. And I was thinking, we've got this format that we're not, we're trying to stick to, but you know, it's still a young podcast. We've interviewed maybe 10 people so far. So we're trying to stick to this where we play music that writers like and with musicians that we talk to talk about writing that they like. So you sent,
that's an interesting idea. Yeah.
Yeah. So you sent me a list of music. And I thought if you'd like to, we could play a bit of a song and then you could say anything you want to say about it or why you chose it or whatever.
Okay.
Watching the sunrise slice through the blind, dust in the room, hovers over my lying here in silence. child still sleeping deep enough to dream. I know I'm a lucky man today, but so afraid the time will take it all from me. Anxiety, how do you always get the best of me? I'm living in a fantasy.
Do you mind if I turn it down?
Yeah.
So how many times have you heard that song?
Quite a few.
Yeah.
I really like that record, yeah.
Cool. It was the first thing on your list. Was it just because you're listening to it a ton currently, or is there something more about it?
So partially that. I love Jason Isbell, and my dad also loves him.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad lives in Southeast Texas. He's very religious and politically conservative.
Oh.
So having this thing that I can share with him, like I send him Jason Isbell CDs for Christmas. It's a thing that we can share and talk about that he really enjoys. And he's always loved music and had a huge country and Western music collection when I was growing up. And so some of my taste is informed by him.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think he's an incredible songwriter.
What I just noticed in this song, it's the first time I've heard it. I don't think I've heard a song that so simply but accurately describes anxiety. Like, I don't know why I didn't expect that, because the song is called Anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
But it's such, just the few words, I've already forgotten the lyrics, but he nailed it. I've had this all my life. I remember as a kid even always feeling like I was in the wrong spot, and I would see my friends just being happy on the playground, and I had a feeling like I'm supposed to be somewhere else. This is weird. And he described that so well.
Mm-hmm. And when he talks about like his kid and his wife, and then the next thought that he has is, that's going to get taken away from me.
Ooh. Yeah, that's sad. I do remember an English teacher in high school trying. He was a great teacher, but we were all misbehaving, and I regret it, because looking back, he was really sharing great things. And he read some poem, and I can't remember what it was, but it had a line about happiness to the point of fear. And he was explaining that. And it always stuck with me, that because we have these, you know, ups and downs, and that moment where everything seems so perfect, so you're afraid this can't last.
Right. Well, because it can't.
Yeah. Right. It won't.
It can't last. And if you're temperamentally anxious, which I also am temperamentally anxious, it's easier to handle things when they're not good, because the bad things already happened.
Yeah.
So you can kind of just like, okay,
how do we deal with this now?
Yeah, I think being happy is a little bit more stressful.
Well, it's probably, there's a bit of that, the fear of the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
Because exactly what you say, if the bad thing already happened, well, you know it now. You know, we can deal with it. You have an essay called There's a Light That Never Goes Out, which is a really great essay.
Thank you.
I was thinking, actually, I didn't warn you beforehand, would you feel like reading that?
Sure.
All right.
You want me to read the whole thing?
It's not that long, is it? It's three
pages?
Yeah, no,
pages? It's a couple pages, three pages. I can read the whole thing.
If you want, you can also stop.
Okay, let's see if I can find it in here.
And then,
you know, your listeners probably know where the title comes from, right?
I don't know.
There is a light that never goes out.
Hold on, let me check. Hey, do you know where? Yeah, they said the Smiths. So.
The Smiths, yeah. There is a light that never goes out. Death is no different whined at than withstood. Philip Larkin. S, this gorgeous freaky girl from Longview I used to know. So pretty, she always had pockets full of drugs from various dirt bags and some genuinely nice guys who wanted to fuck her and thought it might help, liked to share them with me. She and I would get high and drive around dark East Texas roads listening to the Smiths singing our hearts out. She might be the only person ever to have heard me sing at full voice. She had the best music collection, and despite her funereal wardrobe, was radiantly sunny and full of joy. She loved drugs and dancing and music and makeup and intrigues and wild theorizing. And one night when I was 20, she died on my living room floor from a heroin overdose. I had gone to bed early. She was visiting. I didn't know about the heroin. Her other friends said that it wasn't a habit, and her naked body showed no injection sites, save the one. I remember looking at her torso after the paramedics called it. I was in shock, and it's all blurry now, but I knew immediately and clearly that the body meant something different than I thought it did. I was a teenage goth girl during peak AIDS crisis, reading pulp horror novels and writing poems about smoking. I thought about sex a lot, but death, I admit, stayed nearly fully repressed. I didn't indulge in fantasies of glamorous suicide like people I knew, or actual suicide like some others. Church left its mark. Jesus died for sin still uncommitted in my case. So it was death, not sex, that got shelved, TBD. People died at regular intervals, as they do, but I think it didn't touch me. The taboo took. When, 10 years from his own death, Philip Larkin wrote in Obad that death is no different whined at than withstood, he was not only stoically alliterative, but also right. Nothing helps. Religion he dismissed as that vast, moth-eaten musical brocade, and philosophy, specious stuff. Maybe he felt poetry helped, since Obad is the most unflinching poem about death I can think of. Work has to be done, he says at the end, and that's the best he has to offer us. In his case, work was writing poems and being a librarian and confirmed bachelor. He must have been a smooth talker, because he still had lots of affairs, despite having a face like a boiled egg and glasses. No kids, though. After living through World War II and one of the most heavily bombed places in Europe, he probably saw enough suffering and death to regard it with equanimity. Terrible as it was, unlike sex, you could count on it. Every Halloween, I set the table for the dead, like Mom taught me, with pictures of beloved dogs, grandparents, and friends, along with candy, fruit, and booze, in case they come over. Maybe this is cool now, if the decor section of Freddy's is any indication, but when I was a kid, it was weird. Morbid. Even so, I taught my own kids how to do it, too. Do we do it to make friends with death? Is all that cheerful kitsch an attempt to create and connect in the face of our terrible temporary bodies? Or is it plain old magical thinking? I grew up in a peaceful time, so in that way I'm still a child, believing life and afterlife continue forever, no end. S's perfect corpse, no bruises, no nothing, looked empty, as if she had slipped out of herself for a smoke. At her services, they said Jesus held her in his arms, that she smiled at us from heaven. She would have laughed if she'd heard that, but I found it pleasant. I felt blank. Not exactly sad, but like a hole had been torn in the sky, and all you could do was stare and wonder. I got pregnant within the year, my baby born on S's birthday. When sex showed up in Earth's primal ocean, it helped our animal ancestors make new kinds of things and hurry evolution along. Death came with it, a natural consequence. Because our oldest relatives reproduced asexually by cloning, they were, in a sense, eternal. Death was the price paid for evolution towards individuation, towards people. Maybe the goth girl intuits this in her fishnet-encased bones. Making death sexy, or sex-deathy, is her way of managing the twin pillars of reality, the consequences of which may be more real to her once she reaches reproducing age. When I got pregnant, I developed phobias I hadn't had before. Fear of flying, of cancer, of my own history poisoning me. The unthought thing started to seep out. The taboo unstuck. I have reproduced, and now I will die. And then, if I'm very lucky, my kids will reproduce, and then they will die. The sex part of my education is complete, the death part only beginning. I read Obad like a ghost story, a way to give myself the willies. I know the second half of my life will contain more grief than the first, maybe so much that I will welcome life's end, but that feels too big to either whine at or withstand. Will I ever not like life? Honestly, I can't imagine. The end.
Yeah, that's great. Well, there's a lot that I love in that. The imagery of your friend, it's so sad and heartbreaking. But also there's that line about when you had your first kid that you suddenly felt immortality. And I don't know if I've talked to anybody about that, but I had the exact same thing when we got pregnant, that it was the first time I felt my mortality. It was the first time I could see, I mean, I feel like we're always looking ahead, like planning our lives and thinking what we want to do. But it was the first time I sort of saw like to the end, like, oh, this is going to stop soon. Well, not soon, hopefully.
I think we might be designed that way.
Yeah.
Because I don't think anybody would have kids. I think if you felt your mortality, you wouldn't have kids. You have, you don't have it, and then you have kids, and then all of a sudden this sensible part of your brain kicks in that's like, okay, everybody wear their seatbelts.
Right.
We've got 30, 40, 50 more years if we're lucky.
Yeah, that's interesting. Most of my friends don't have kids for whatever reason. That's who I end up hanging out with. But there's definitely always, I feel like I'm always on a slightly different plane.
Yeah.
I don't know what else to say about that.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah.
I think you are for all kinds of reasons. And I am back on that plane with the people who don't have kids.
Oh, right. Your kids are gone now.
Right. And lot of my friends who didn't have kids when I had kids now have kids because they didn't have kids until their late 30s
right.
or early 40s, mm-hmm. like sensible people.
Yeah, yeah.
Instead of in their early 20s like I did.
Right.
And it looks so hard.
Oh, yeah. I see people also having these babies and I just want to turn away like, oh,
it's so hard.
I want nothing to do with that. Mm-hmm. Are you going out constantly with your partner having fun now?
No, this is embarrassing. No, I stay home. I have a spotlessly clean house and I like to stay home and hang out with my dogs.
I thought...
And him, I like to cook. Like, I'm super homebody right now.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I remember really hit me after having a kid is all that stuff. It took a while. Those first couple of years are really tough. And it took a while before we could finally, like, just go out for drinks. And I thought I was really missing it.
Mm-hmm.
And once we did, I thought, this is so flat. I don't care. This is nothing to me. So I can totally get that you wouldn't go.
I think when my kids started to be around school age, when I was in my early 30s, I had a period of wanting to go out again and be super social again. So yeah. I think it comes back around. Mm-hmm. But yeah, at this stage of my life, most of the time it doesn't seem like fun.
Yeah. You mentioned, it sounds like you have a really great relationship with your dad. That's awesome, I think.
I love my dad.
That's great.
I don't know if we have a really great relationship. No, that's not true. We do have a really great relationship. Is anything happening in the news?
Not since last week.
He texted me today saying, Portland is in the news again. I hope you're staying safe.
But he watches Fox.
Right. So he has this sort of weird vision of what, like, that I'm, like, dodging protesters. And, like, it's so funny to me because Portland is such a, like, wide streets and big trees and farmers markets. And it's so different from what it is like in his mind.
Yeah. I'm impressed that you can maintain a good relationship or whatever you want to call it with someone in your family. Given now the way politics are.
I think it's really important. I wish more people, I really value that I grew up in a conservative place because I understand conservative people and thinking in a way that prevents me from thinking that they're monsters.
It's fun. I'm glad to hear that because I did not grow up in a conservative place. So it's hard for me not to think anything but like that they're all monsters because of the people that represent them in the political world.
Right. And unfortunately, the more you talk about people and treat people as if they're monsters,
right,
the worse and more polarizing everything gets.
Yeah.
And so I feel good that I have that connection and that I can remember that, especially when it's really, really hard. It is right now, you know, it's really hard.
Yeah.
But so I'm grateful for that. And I always think I think the way to save the country is for everybody to move back to their hometown. I know. Nobody wants to take the bullet.
I hated my hometown.
Me neither.
Oh, God. Sounds awful.
But if the people on the coast could sort of start filling in the red states in the middle, we could revitalize the center of the country. We'd have to learn to start getting along. You know, places where people, New York City is a great example. It's a really vibrant culture, partially because there's so much difference.
Yeah, yeah.
And people learn to get along.
Yeah, yeah. Do you talk about politics with your dad?
Very rarely.
Yeah, that's
very rarely because it's too infuriating.
Yeah.
So I used to, obviously, when I was younger, like all young people, I did. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, okay, we're not doing that anymore. Occasionally, I will think that something's important enough to actually attempt a conversation with. And not even that it's important enough that I think that there's a place where I can make a connection with him. Mm-hmm. When I see an opportunity for a way to reach him, because my father's very strong values.
Yeah.
And he feels very deeply that people should do the right thing, and he believes in honor and fairness and all of these things that we don't necessarily always associate with conservatives.
Right.
And sometimes he's wrong thinking, but his goal is always to do the morally correct thing.
It's so that is what I would associate with conservatives of an older time. And I wish that that is how I felt conservatives were.
Well, I think that a lot of those conservatives are they're just not the conservatives on the news. And they're not the conservatives in office.
Right.
But I think that, again, like if you are around those people, you recognize that like everybody wants their kids to go to a good school.
Right.
Everybody wants there to be enough food. Everybody wants the tax money to go to appropriate places and for there not to be corruption. Mm-hmm. Like everybody kind of wants the same thing. But we don't talk to those people because they're boring.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, we talk to the people in the MAGA men going their own way.
Oh.
Those people. Like the most sort of disgusting.
Oh, that's what you mean the news, they talk to them. Oh, mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. That's not, I don't want to keep talking about politics. Although it's real, I do really appreciate that. There was a time I was waiting for my kid on the playground and his friend's grandfather was visiting to pick him up. And I just started chatting with him and he was from, I don't know where, Tennessee or someplace, and he seemed really nice, but then he very quickly and weirdly went into something that so clearly sounded like he was repeating something he had heard on Fox or a conservative radio, and it was strange for me, but it also put a gut reaction in me where I was like, I just now want to get away from you, because it felt the same as when I used to live around a lot of religious people. Mm-hmm. And they would quickly switch into something. And I remember then trying to talk to them. And whenever I would ask a question that they didn't know, they would say, well, the Bible says this. And that's the end of the conversation. And I feel that way with modern day conservatives, that if you try to talk about any issues, it's sort of like, well, I heard this or I know this and that's the end of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are sensible conservatives out there. I can't believe I'm saying this in this forum. I think it's important. I've had a version of this project my whole entire life.
Yeah.
But where I try to find the best possible argument for the thing I don't believe in. So I try to find the argument I can respect. So looking for respectable conservative arguments. Now, I think that those are not mainstream conservative arguments.
Yeah.
I think they're very different than what the president says or what's on Fox News or any of those things. But I do think that there are respectable conservative arguments to be made. And the more we kind of understand that, the more we can kind of we can find common ground to communicate with one another. And same with religious, because again, I was also raised in a very religious community. Mm-hmm. There are religious positions and religious ideologies, even in fundamentalist Christianity, that you can kind of make peace with. And then there's other stuff that seems insane.
Yeah, yeah, I get that. Want to hear another song?
Sure.
Okay.
Coleman Bach playing fool. He's a backwoods rounder and a breaker of mule. Coleman Bach's got a wore out bow. He's been playing 2 days down the New Cut Road. Now Coleman's little sister said, you better act right, Coleman. Daddy's gone to Louisville. He'll be back tonight. He gonna get another wagon and a good pair of mule. Well, we're gonna move to Texas. Just waiting on you. Now Coleman's daddy, he pulled up in the yard and he said, pack up your lives, kids, it's getting too hard. Kentucky's all right, but there's too many people. Oh, just the other day I thought I saw a church steeple. Now Coleman said, daddy, don't you worry about me, 'cause I'm gonna stay here in Kentucky till the day I die. I'm gonna drink that sour mash, I'm gonna race that mare. Ooh, I've got me a woman with fox red hair. Now I've been moving west since the day you got married. Well, I'm getting off the wagon, daddy, I'm too old to be carried. I'm gonna stay here in Kentucky where that bluegrass grows. And I'm gonna play it all night down the New Cut Road.
I love that.
It's, see, that has everything.
Yeah, it's it also sounds how can it just so it has all these older styles, not what I would associate with modern country music.
Well, Guy Clark is a songwriter. Do you know, are you familiar with Guy Clark?
No, I don't know.
He's more famous as a songwriter than as a performer, and he's from East Texas, where I'm from, and he's written a million songs that other people have covered. And made a nice tidy income for himself. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, his style is folky, traditional country, which is what I prefer.
Yeah.
And bluegrass, which is great.
Yeah. How long has Guy Clark been around?
Forever. He's okay. A million. he's probably as old as Willie Nelson.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool. So then have you listened to him pretty much your whole life?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's cool. It brings me back a little bit to what you were saying before, which I appreciate. And I've mentioned this to a coworker once when she was playing some country music just during opening. We can play whatever we want. And I was trying to listen to it, and I was telling her that I was struggling with, because the way current politics are, that when I hear country, I just think, oh, racists and gun-loving people,
mm-hmm.
and it makes me uncomfortable. And I knew she wasn't that, so but I just thought, I want to speak this out because holding it in is dumb. So I just said, this is how I'm feeling, and I know it's not accurate, but when I hear that music, it makes me think that.
Well, here's an interesting idea that I heard about, I heard this a few years ago, and I can't remember who said it, but they were talking about how Dolly Parton and some other people are really popular all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
Like, someplace in Africa was where the news story was, and they were talking about the person's theory that the reason people love country music is because it's music of the diaspora. It's for people who are homesick.
Oh.
And so that, I think that is true and appealing, an appealing idea. And also, I like the tight rhymes in country music and bluegrass, which as a poet, you don't hear that. You don't hear those like hooked up rhymes in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, you know, you can hear a bunch of nonsense if you listen to contemporary country radio,
which is
appallingly terrible.
It's barely country anymore.
No, it's some horrible hybrid.
Yeah.
But it's also, my friend, I have a my Kira, who lives in your old house,
yeah,
always says she likes to listen to country music because the message is not to be aspirational, but to like what you have.
Oh.
Because it's all about, like, this is my woman, and this is my truck, and I'm happy with my sweetheart that I've been married to for 50 years, and my land, and as opposed to, like, wanting and longing, which, like, rock and roll is much more romantic, and so it's about wanting things. And but, so
yeah,
that's kind of a nice way to think about it, too.
I like that. But you just said that it's also for people that are homesick, which sounds like...
Right, because it's romanticizing that thing. It's like romanticizing the sort of simple, anchored, happy with what you have.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. I do feel like I have to constantly remind myself, like, look around. And at least in my little personal world, things are pretty good.
Yeah, it's good to remember that.
Yeah.
Do you meditate?
I do, but the thing is, I'm a horrible meditator, but a great napper. So it always turns into a nap.
I think that's okay.
Is it? I don't know if that's real meditation.
Well, I'm a terrible napper.
Oh.
But a great meditator.
Well, that's good. Because I will often try to meditate. Like even in my kids, I bring him to a kung fu class that he does several times a week. And it's loud. And I'm sitting in the chair like the other dads meditating. And then like in 5 minutes, I'm snoring.
I bet you're not the only one that falls asleep like that.
Well, no, all the others are looking at their phones.
Really?
Yeah.
I bet if they put their phones down, they'd fall asleep too.
Yeah, they're missing a good nap hour.
Mm-hmm. See, I can't nap at all.
It's wonderful. If you try in the middle of the day after lunch, if you're not working, it's the best.
See, it's not though, because I wake up panicked.
Oh.
Like, do you remember being a little kid and falling asleep after school and then waking up and feeling like you missed something? Like you missed dinner or like some weird, like sweaty.
I mean, I can imagine it. I don't
like
think
that. That's why I don't like. But I wake up in the morning, I don't feel that way. But after a nap, I always feel like weird and grumpy and disoriented.
I think that's common. I feel sort of emotional after I wake up, just kind of like, oh.
Oh, see, that's good. If you feel like that, you should nap all the time.
I do. I love
Screw
it.
Screw meditating.
Well, nap. Yeah. Yeah. It works for me. All right, on that note, we're going to listen to a little Lucinda Williams.
Sitting in the kitchen, the house of Macon, Loretta singing on the radio, smell of coffee, eggs and bacon, car wheels on a gravel road. Pull the curtains back and look outside. Somebody somewhere don't know. Come on now, child, we're gonna go for a ride. Car wheels on a gravel road. Car wheels on a gravel road.
So, do you remember discovering Lucinda Williams?
Yes, kind of. I don't remember. I was here already, I think.
Mm-hmm.
She used to play in Austin when I lived in Austin, but she wasn't necessarily super on my radar. She was just sort of in the world. But then when that album came out, Car Wheels on a Gravel Road, I listened to it constantly. And it will make me burst into tears.
Mm.
Almost all the songs on there, if they catch me off guard, will make me burst into tears.
Oh. She has a really an older style that I like in her voice.
Mm-hmm. She has a really unusual voice. And she, again, great lyrics. I guess her dad was a poet.
Huh.
She tells a story about getting taken to Flannery O'Connor's house.
Wow.
When she was little.
Wow.
And like chasing the, because she had peacocks, like chasing Flannery O'Connor's peacocks around the yard. Like, come on.
They're loud. Cannot.
Yeah.
They scream.
And terrifying. If you're little, I mean.
I remember in college, I dated a girl that lived out in the country. I mean, it was a small college town, but there was out, whatever. But there were peacocks on, and I, the first time I went to visit her, like I got out of the car and said hi, and she said hi, and right behind me a peacock screamed.
Did you scream?
I probably just jumped. I was like, what the hell am I gotten into? Yeah, I didn't know how loud they are. You mentioned how much you like the rhymes of country music. I couldn't help but curious if you if that draws you to hip hop as at all.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. My son is super into hip hop, so I think not reluctantly interested in it, but it just wasn't something that I necessarily listened to all that much until it was on the house all the time.
Right.
And then I developed a real appreciation for it. I think it takes some training to listen to it well, to listen to the lyrics well, and be able to really kind of process them and hear them. Because I think when you first try, yeah, the like the rhythm, it's not if it's not the like it's not country music, it's not like the rhythms are fast and it's not what you're used to. But then, yeah, then I like it now. Yeah,
I feel I think that's with any music. If you don't grow up listening to it, when you just hear little bits, it's hard. It just takes exposure with anything.
Right. Well, and it's so much faster now. Like,
is it
not, kind of like 90s hip hop? Like, if you think about like Public Enemy or something, like mostly the rhymes were pretty clear. Like you could hear it, even Biggie Smalls.
Yeah.
You can, but now I think it's the delivery's faster, and also the slang I'm unfamiliar with.
Oh yeah.
I'm old, so it took a little bit of time.
I'm definitely not on the pulse. There's a guy that I work with that plays it quite a bit, so he's re-educating me. But I have the impression that it's starting to slow down and get a little bit more chill. But I don't
know. some of it definitely is, I think. Who does my son likes? Who's Milo?
Oh yeah.
And it's like sounds like jazz.
Cool. I did for there's a question I wanted to ask that I forgot about your book. You said it came from essays that you wrote in your column for 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
How often were those columns coming out?
Depends on how on top of it I was. Between 3 and 6 times a year.
Mm-hmm. And how, like, what percentage made the book?
There's a couple from the column that aren't in the book, and there's a couple that I wrote specifically for the book.
Oh, what prompted that? Did you just want something new?
I was like, it's gonna be a tiny book. Yeah. Like I knew how many columns there were, and I was like, and they're very short.
Yeah,
it's like I don't know if it's gonna be long enough. And then also I felt like there were a few things when I looked at it as a whole. I was like, what else do I have to say?
Mm-hmm.
And like my son was like, you have an essay in there about Sully, and you don't have one about me, so you better write one about me. So I did.
That's funny. I love books this size. I typically, when someone recommends a book and I check it out and it's 500 pages, I thought, oh no. Because
yeah,
always at least 200 of the pages could have been cut out.
Right. It better be a page turner.
Yeah.
If it's 500 pages.
Yeah. Although I just heard an author that I haven't read, someone recommended, I don't know how to say her name, Tana French. Have you heard of her? She's Irish, I think.
No.
She writes mysteries and detective stories. But anyway, her new book is 500-something pages, but people say it's a page turner.
I'll read 500 pages of trash, no problem. Like sci-fi, fantasy, mystery, anything like that.
What do you have authors that you like?
I've been reading what's her name? Jacqueline Carey, who writes these fantasy novels about a place where there's the government, and then there's also prostitutes, and they're like at the same level as government. The society is sort of built around this thing, and it's very, like, tons of political intrigue and stuff. I've read, like, four of those in the past over the summer.
Does it what do you like about it?
Well, I mean, it's track. Like, the same thing. Everybody, like, there's...
Just easy entertainment.
There's, like, you know, elaborate descriptions of costumes, and everyone's very dashing, and then, you know, there's a lot of drama and intrigue and excitement. There's, you know, politics that don't make you weep. Like, there's all, like, there's all kinds of stuff.
It's escapism, probably.
Yeah.
You mentioned it, I think you mentioned a little bit in your book, liking that in Hays era, Hays Code era movies.
Oh, yeah.
Do the books have the same thing as those movies, where it can surprise you with emotional pulls?
I think that there certainly is there's absolutely genre fiction that is art, and that can surprise you with that. I don't think those books are that.
Yeah, okay. Well,
they're not art in the same way like a Hitchcock movie is art.
Yeah, yeah. I was just wondering, because you called it trash, so I was wondering if...
I mean trash it in the most loving possible way.
I assumed that.
That they, in that I can put them down and I don't necessarily have to think about them again.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is almost a form of meditation. You're letting go of your own world for a moment and just staying awake, but doing that.
Yeah, and, you know, once the school year starts, I don't have time to read like that. Oh. So it is a real luxury.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Would you like to hear some, I don't know how to, is it Jillian or Gillian Welch?
Jillian? Yeah. Jillian?
I don't know.
Jillian Welch.
You would know better.
Gillian Welch.
All right, here we go.
I was thinking that night about Elvis. Did he die? Did he die? I was thinking that night about Elvis. Did he die? Did he die? Just a country boy that combed his hair and put on a shirt his mother made and went on. And it shook it like a Harlem queen. It shook it like a midnight rambler, baby, like you never seen, like you never seen, never seen. I was thinking that night about Elvis. Did he die? Did he die? I was thinking that night about Elvis. Did he die? Did he die? That it took it all out of black and white, grabbing one and the other hand and it held on tight. It shook it like to make it break. It shook it like a holy roller, baby, with his soul at stake.
She's amazing.
Great. So great.
The beginning reminded me of Robert Johnson before they got into the vocal harmonies.
I could hear that.
Only because... I made that connection only because listening to it, it put me back into, I think, like some college apartment that I lived in and was listening to Robert Johnson. Suddenly I was sitting on that carpet again and it was raining out.
I love the idea of Elvis as like a transgender figure. It makes you feel such tenderness for him to think about him. And he was like, he's beautiful like a woman.
Yeah.
And he was so like vulnerable in the world. Yeah. People kind of taking advantage of him. We don't think of him that way. and it seems sweet.
Yeah, that is a wonderful way to sort of give you that twist of perspective. Well, this has been a really good conversation. Is there anything you wanted to talk about?
Buy my book.
Yeah. We'll put links to it on the website. I mean, I'm assuming it'll be sold out by the time this comes out, but you'll do another printing.
Of course.
Okay.
Thank you. Cool. Thank you so much,
yeah,
Sonny.
Thanks,
Wendy. That was fun.
You're listening to The Steer, recorded at KBOO Radio, broadcast on dublab.com, hosted by Jeff Alessandrelli and Sonny Bleckinger. For more, see our website at www.the-steer.com. You can download our episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, and anywhere podcasts are found.